The Boulder Tech Podcast is presented by Honey, the online shopping platform that helps consumers save time and money, is building a Boulder office and looking for software engineers to join the team. Find out more at joinhoney.com/careers. Welcome to the Boulder Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Joel Davis. We have a unique startup and tech community here on the edge of the Rockies, and we want you to know about it. The Boulder Tech Podcast features conversations with leaders, thinkers, and influencers, sharing their views on what's happening in Boulder's rapidly evolving tech scene. These interviews were recorded during the 9th annual Boulder Startup Week. When it started in 2009, Boulder Startup Week was the first event of its kind, anywhere. Now, Startup Weeks are held around the world. It's a great example of Boulder's position on the leading edge of tech and the future. Episode number 17 of the Boulder Tech Podcast features Mary Catherine Keller, Boulder Community Fellow at Watson Institute. We talk about her work mentoring at-risk teens in Boulder, how she's had a startup mindset since she was 12 and where that's leading her, Boulder's reputational marketplace, and her advocacy for agency over apathy. What does the Watson Institute do?
So the Watson Institute is a social impact incubator for social impact startups and nonprofits. So currently there's a campus here in Boulder and they're based in Chautauqua Park, which is an incredible location, but we have students from all over the world come and focus on their idea that they have or maybe their existing company or nonprofit and look at scaling those. And then they're actually about to open a second campus at Lynn University, which is in Boca Raton, Florida.
How long have you been at Watson Institute?
So I originally came in as a, they call them scholars. So I came into Watson almost 3 years ago. It was the fall of 2015. And I was there for 2 years. And then through a really awesome philanthropist in town, had the opportunity to stick around this year. And so my kind of primary role actually is I work with students at a local high school who are at-risk students on effective communication and team building. And so that's about 25-ish% of my time. And then the rest of that, I kind of decided that this would just be basically like a give year. And so I have spent time at CU collaborating with some of their innovation entrepreneurship initiative work, which has been really cool. And then working some with Watson students.
And what's your background in all of this?
Well, my parents are both small business owners. And I saw at a young age how interesting it could be to kind of create something that was your own and maybe that other people were doing and maybe they weren't. And as part of that, through my mom, I think was some of my kind of first exposure to entrepreneurship as well as one of my neighbors. But I saw my first like collegiate pitch competition when I was like, I guess 12 and, or maybe 11. And then also saw like a young entrepreneurship, it was called the Young Entrepreneurship Showcase. It was Yes for Arkansas. And I saw that when I was around the same age. And that was kind of what I think got me started and like interested in entrepreneurship. And I started a company with a couple friends. I was like 12, I guess. And when I was in the eighth grade but then things got busy in high school and kind of got out of it and ended up actually kind of finding my way into politics and ultimately kind of circled back to entrepreneurship when I felt like, especially with social impact entrepreneurship, you can potentially improve lives, not through policy making, which can be really slow, but through business and really effective and efficiently run nonprofits.
Can you give any examples of startups that have come through Watson and what they're doing and the kind of social impact they're having?
Yeah. So most recently, one of the ones that I think is really interesting is a company called Veganarchy. The founder, Abhay, is originally from Bangalore, India. That's actually where he's back there now. But it's a vegan milk and yogurt company. And I, growing up in the South, with like hunting and barbecue being an integral part of the culture, like I'm not vegan, but it's something that I think is really interesting because what he is doing is really driven by this belief around, you know, protecting animals. And I think that that's really incredible and also to a certain degree, like looking at like a healthier plant-based diet, because he's helping to make vegan milk and yogurt more accessible to people by making it at a much cheaper rate than existing market solutions there, which include Silk Milk, you know, like other brands are there, but they're much more expensive because they're obviously imported. So kind of things like that. Another one would be Gideon, which is a legal tech startup that basically helps triage incoming clients. And so there's a potential for that, obviously, within traditional like B2C, where you have a lawyer that serves people who have been in accidents, and helping to kind of effectively triage and figure out like, is that person the best fit for that law firm? But there's also the potential for that to work really well when it comes to free and reduced legal aid, because 80% of people who apply for free and reduced legal aid aren't able to actually get it because the supply just cannot meet the demand, even though they qualify for it. So things like that, where you're kind of improving existing structure and it's obviously like scalable and people can buy into it because it's a great business, but also has the potential to really drive social change and like influence people's lives, is really intriguing to me, but also just profound to me.
So. Talk a little more about the high school kids you're working with.
The high school students I get to work with kind of blow my mind. It's one of those classic things of, I was brought in to kind of work with them and like teach them. But I know that the reality is that I've learned far more from that experience, or I feel like I've learned far more from that experience than sometimes I wonder than, you know, they have. So almost all the students that I work with are Latinx students, which is really interesting. I think, especially when you talk about Boulder, And sometimes that's a topic that comes up that I do some stuff with some high school students. People are often surprised to when you say like low income or at risk students, they're like, oh, does that mean, you know, their family has like what, like one Tesla? Like those poor people. But it's interesting because there's very much a population and a diversity here in Boulder that I think people don't always see. And so it's been a very eye-opening experience.
So is what you're doing with the high school students related to Watson Institute, or that's just another thing you're doing to spend your time during this give year?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not directly related to Watson. I got into it when I was a scholar at Watson. The philanthropist I work with came to Watson and was like, hey, you know, I'm going to be running this mentorship program. This was last year. And basically asked if there were any students I think that, you know, might be a good fit for that. And I was kind of referred to that because I had a kind of interesting, wild high school career. And by that, I mean, I left at semester at the end of my fall semester, my senior year. And so, definitely kind of had a bit of a divergent high school path, but yeah, so that it's kind of related, but more of it is kind of unrelated, I guess, to Watson.
And you also, you said you do work for the Innovation Initiative?
Yes. I don't work for them. Mm-hmm. I joke that around Boulder, I don't really work for anyone. I just lurk with everyone. But I've been really fortunate to be able to kind of lurk with what they're doing and everything from just kind of sitting in on meetings and understanding kind of processes, which I think are really fascinating, and also just kind of volunteering in different capacities. And so whether that's, you know, the New Venture Challenge finals night at Boulder Theater and kind of helping with different things related to like operations in that moment, or all I was able to facilitate some, call them POPs, which are pitch open practices. And so having the opportunity to kind of help bring together students and faculty that were interested in starting startups and mentors who then were able to help them kind of refine their pitches. That was something that was really interesting and really cool opportunity to kind of see an iterative process of learning, like, what can we do better next time? And then actually having the chance to kind of iterate on those, because that was like a series of events.
Could you comment on the view of the Boulder startup scene from the CU perspective? Like, how do they, is it something that's just sort of out there, or is it something that there's a strong connection or somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I can only really make comments as an observer. And in that way, I've been really privileged to be an observer in a lot of like different capacities around town, I think. there is definitely an interest on the university's part, as we've seen across the country, when it comes to entrepreneurship and startups. I think academic institutions, like anything else, are businesses. And so they're going to find, you know, what's hot at the moment and sell that. And so I think that, you know, across the country, you've really seen a rise in the, you know, past decade plus of entrepreneurship and innovation initiatives, of degrees or certificates or, you know, programming around entrepreneurship. I think it's interesting within Boulder more broadly, but even at CU, of sometimes there's a disconnect and a lack of awareness or understanding what other people are up to. And it's also interesting because depending on who you talk to, whether they're in Boulder or even out of Boulder, the perception of Boulder can be so vastly different. You know, it's either people looking at it and being like, oh, wow, yeah, like that crazy party school. Or it's some people see it, obviously, like for the outdoor industry, some people, and then, you know, others see it for it kind of being this like food mecca, this, you know, with the natural food industry. And then other people think of Techstars and think of, you know, the startup scene here. And so it's, I think it's interesting how there is some overlap, but sometimes people aren't always aware of the entire landscape and see kind of the interconnectedness between it.
And what brought you to Boulder?
Watson. It was funny. I actually heard about Watson in Las Vegas and overheard a girl who's now one of my closest friends speaking about it to somebody else at a conference. And when she was done talking, I was like, hey, what was that thing you were talking about? That sounds really cool. Yeah. And then like 10-ish months later, I ended up coming out here for Watson.
Do you see yourself staying here for a while?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. I think it changes on the day. I really enjoy Boulder. I think it's a really incredible space and kind of playground for ideas and for companies, for people. There's a really big focus on kind of growth and improvement here, which I think is really cool. But sometimes I do think, you know, Boulder can also very much be a bubble and not exist really in the rest of the world. And so, yeah, sometimes to be frank, I'm not quite sure.
Fair enough. Have you ever heard the description of Boulder as 27 square miles surrounded by reality?
I have. And then there's a great little breakfast spot called the Village Coffee Shop that, and their t-shirts is like, we're, you know, however many square feet of reality in Boulder, which I think is funny. Yeah, I mean, growing up in the South, sometimes there's this mentality or kind of arrogance that comes off from people of like them being holier than thou. And I remember when I moved to Boulder, sometimes I got this weird impression from people and I was like, what is this? Like, it just, it's something like, there's some like weird thing. And I basically, have, you know, kind of categorized it as like people, sometimes people here can almost be more mindful than thou. It's like, oh, well, you know, I have a, you know, ultra recycled, awesome yoga mat and my kale is hyper local. So eat it, you know, like kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's not true across like the board with everything, but I think it is like Boulder objectively to me, it's just like a really fascinating place in that way.
Do you think that bubbleness is ultimately maybe a benefit for the tech community or a handicap, maybe a little bit of both?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think it depends. It's something where it really depends on what you're doing. So a prime example that's not necessarily tech related, but I think kind of just like kind of be a story on how much of a bubble I think this is when Hillary Clinton lost the 2016 election, there were so many people that I talked to that were just very blindsided and baffled and just couldn't quite understand who were these people that didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. And I think that it's something where, in the same way that I see a lot of, And that's also wasn't exclusive to Boulder. I think people across the country, especially in urban centers, definitely felt that. But as somebody that comes from a place that's not always on the forefront of technology and development, but that represents, you know, and is kind of similar to about 50% of America, I think that it's interesting when people in Boulder and even in San Francisco or other tech communities as well, like think that they've created a truly disruptive technology and fail to sometimes think about how they're missing out on entire market segments, and that it's not like they've hit kind of ubiquity or like market saturation across the board. Another example of that would be I was back in Arkansas last summer, and there was a, you know, like a teaser on the local news for like, and coming up, a new ride sharing application is coming to, you know, Little Rock. And it was like Lyft, Uber, like, okay, what's, you know, what else is it going to be? And it was actually for Lyft, because Lyft had just made it to Arkansas. And so I think it's something where, you know, it's easy to think that, especially when you're kind of in this bubble, that you've made it or that you've really disrupted things. But I think that sometimes people lack awareness of life outside urban centers, or, you know, Boulder especially.
How would you characterize the Boulder tech scene, startup scene?
Accessible. I think that one of the things that's really unique about Boulder is that you've got like approximately 90,000 people. I could be like a little off on that, but you have a relatively small, I mean, this is like a town. I mean, we're not like a super small town, but we're not a city, we're a town. And I think that that's really interesting in that it creates kind of on ramps for access in a way that might not be as accessible or prevalent in bigger places. And, you know, I mean, it's funny because I was thinking the other day about there's almost like a absurdity component of like how small of a town Boulder is to a certain degree. But also I think that that's what also makes it great, is that you can kind of build relationships with people. And, you know, and there are obviously exceptions, but a lot of people here are very accessible, and people here are very much incentivized kind of through this like reputational marketplace almost thing of being a connector within the Boulder ecosystem and kind of perpetuating this growth. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's cool that people can be very accessible in Boulder.
You said you worked in politics, or
yeah.
Were you involved at all in the last election?
I was not. I had an offer to get into that in 2014, I guess. By that point, I had pretty well decided I wanted to kind of look at other things. I think that politics is fascinating. I joke that it's, you know, like my dirty little like love affair kind of thing. I read a lot about politics and about a lot of other things as well. But no, to a short answer, no, I wasn't involved in that election.
Do you have any observations though on how it went and tech's role, you know, the startup community's role in that?
Yeah. I mean, I can't speak specifically to obviously the 2016 presidential election because I was not involved in that one specifically, but I do have an awareness of, I guess, some of the kind of industry practice, I guess, if you will. As somebody that's also that reads about politics, but also reads a lot about like cybersecurity, it kind of blows my mind at times that people interact digitally and go about their lives in the same way that they act in their car. So like, I don't know if you've ever seen like looked over and seen someone like picking their nose in their car and they're like, oh, this is my bubble and my space. No one is going to see or notice that, right? Or even they're like dancing in their car, right? And I think it's easy to kind of go about our lives and assume that we are protected. But I think for me, it's something where I kind of operate under the assumption, and I think I would say other people should, I don't want to tell people what to do, but it's something where I think that for me, I operate under the assumption that anything I ever do digitally, and even not doing digitally, if you walk by an ATM machine, right? Like anything that you say, do, type, even if you backspace and delete it, and you don't even post it, is in some way traceable, searchable, known. And not that it is, but I think that if you can come to terms with that, and I don't know, not that you shouldn't have to accept it, I guess, but if you can come to terms with that and operate in that kind of way, and then think about what you're doing, then I think that it might influence people's behavior a little bit differently. That said, I mean, there are all sorts of tools, and Cambridge Analytica was not the first. And we've been, I say we, but like companies for years have been collecting data on people. And I think now it's easy to pinpoint and say like, oh, Facebook, or like, oh, Twitter, as these like ultimate evil kind of, you know, root causes of people's data being exposed. But the reality is that like if you have a cell phone, if you use a credit card, if you have an internet service provider, those people actually might have more data on you than Facebook does, because they know your location, they know your spending habits. And yeah, so I mean, it's just interesting. I'm glad that this is coming to the forefront of people's consciousness. I think that especially as we continue to become more tech-driven, having an understanding, but also a drive to discuss and shape the ethics of our technology is imperative. And I think that until more recently, we've just kind of been consumers, rather realizing that we're also creating and we are the product. So figuring out and encouraging people to be more conscientious about that, I think is really important, both on the consumer side, but also from a development side, from like looking at technologists, like how can we drive I think it's really important to drive a conversation around like understanding how your product might be used in malicious ways, or I don't know, manipulated in the future. But yeah, I mean, I just think that that's important that we're actually having this conversation, and I think it's very long overdue.
So I think I already know the answer to this, but would you say that tech has sort of an ethical obligation to, well, I mean, they have all that info doesn't mean they should necessarily use it.
Totally. I definitely think that tech has an ethical obligation to their users currently and in the past, but also in the future, especially when you look at from a development standpoint. Sometimes there's this, you know, kind of idea of like, fuck it, ship it. Like, let's just, you know, think fast, build fast, like drive into the ground, like sink or sail, like let's see what works. And I think on one side, that's a really like cool mindset. But I also think that there has to be more conscientiousness around what are you creating? What are the security kind of parameters around it? And what's protecting your users? And also encouraging conversation around like how companies can continue to be sustainable without having to offload all of their information they have about people, because they're economically incentivized to do so.
How do you see us getting to that point?
Well, I think it's interesting because there's been a push, if you will, from actually a number of like big tech companies saying, hey, like we should create policy around this. And that's something where I think that as much as I am a fan of kind of market-based solutions, but there are also times when I think it's interesting that big players in the market are saying like, it's important that we don't just let the market dictate this, and that we need to have policy shaping the development and creation and security around what we're building. I think that's especially true, and people, you know, have thought about that some with like when it comes to artificial intelligence, but you know, not even something as big and wild as artificial intelligence, but even just thinking about like Twitter. And I'm a big fan of Twitter. I think Twitter's fascinating. I think that it's also a incredible asset to people who are in academia. Last year, I went to this event at the university called the Big Data Blitz. And it was basically just a number of different professors speaking to how they were doing research that involved big data. And so it was everything from kind of emergency management to, biology to, you name it, somebody was doing research. And what was really interesting to me was that the number of people who were using data from Twitter, and granted, like they're getting massive data sets. It's not like they're, you know, and it's anonymized or, you know, whatever else, but also looking at something where on one side, like taking data from Twitter to do academic research that's phenomenal. But at the same time, like it's finding that balance, because the same analytics that is propelling better emergency responses to major disasters can also be used in more negative ways through similar like processes. I think it's awesome. I just also think that people need to be mindful of what they're sharing, and that the industry has an obligation to be more ethically mindful about it.
The industry has the obligation to be more ethically mindful about it, but there is also maybe a little bit of save us from ourselves sort of thing. And in the meantime, as a consumer or a civilian or a product,
yeah,
we need to be mindful.
Absolutely.
And be responsible for what we're doing. And
totally. Well, and I think that also goes back to like, for me, one of my kind of persistent beliefs is that like climate change won't kill us. Mass, you know, event like terror events or shootings today, like there was the 22nd school shooting in this year, like, which is just objectively absurd. And it's not shootings or acts of terror or, you know, acts of God, if you will, that will kill us. It's actually apathy. And I think that translates to, you know, whether it's looking at things like gun violence or climate change, or whether it's looking at your personal security and your data being shared and how that shapes events around us, and thinking that it doesn't matter, that we don't have control over it, or that we can't demand more, and that we're powerless. And so I think that for me, like, one of the reasons that I actually really love working with and have a big belief in, especially like high school students, and it's continued to obviously like come to the forefront with, when you look at like the Parkland survivors and the students from that school, like, that there's a belief that like action can be taken. And I think part of that's driven by, there's a 17th century abolitionist, William Wilberforce from England, that had a quote that was like, we're too young to know that certain things are impossible, so we'll do them anyway. And so I think that there's a beauty in youth that allows for people to maybe not be as jaded, and think that they do have more agency over their lives or the outcomes or their environment. But I think that all of us have a lot to learn, and I hope that we can continue to recognize that we do have a sense of agency with certain things, and that being apathetic and just turning off isn't the answer either.
Well, exactly. And the Parkland example is a great one, because that's maybe a step towards the end of apathy, because I fully agree with you that apathy is a huge part of why we are where we are. And a lot of people don't seem to see that somehow. Yeah. And unfortunately, some tragedies have come about, but they've led to this activism from these students. It's incredible and hopefully contagious and continues. And unfortunately, we may have some more.
Totally. And yeah. And the reality is that, like, this won't be, you know, the one today is not the last. And I can say that with like absolute certainty. And I don't like saying that. And there's also, is somebody that's like works in high school. You know, every once in a while, like, I think it's absurd that like, I think about like, oh, what would my plan be in this room? Like, what do I, like, no one should have to think about that. That's actually absurd. But also thinking that we do have power and agency, and that it's part of it's just tapping into that.
Well, thanks for your work and helping to do that with the youth. Anything else you'd like to add about anything?
When it comes to tech in Boulder, I think that Boulder is a place that thrives on quitters and losers. And by that, I mean people who have kind of just said, you know, like, ah, like, I'm going to quit this path that I'm on, this path that's like dictated by society. That's like, oh, this is what you're supposed to do, or this is what you should do. And I love and very much revel in, you know, the idea that everyone should, you know, stop shooting themselves. But at the same time, I think one of the conversations that I do want to see happen more, especially when it comes to diversity and inclusion, is looking at the immense amount of privilege that's involved in not just tech more broadly, but especially entrepreneurship. It's interesting, because I think that being able to say, I'm going to quit what I'm doing, and I may or may not necessarily need to have an income, or I can decrease my income and be just fine, is an immense amount of privilege. And even when you look at things like healthcare, for example, like, how many people stay doing what they're doing because they're dependent upon the healthcare that they receive at the job that they're in, right? So, and not that if we had a different healthcare system that loads of people would be starting businesses, but I do think that one of the conversations I really want to continue to see, whether it's in addition to kind of the general conversation around kind of the Me Too, and especially when it comes to tech, is one of diversity and inclusion, and looking at, you know, not just how colorful or, you know, representative of different people is your team on a surface level, but also how can we create more on-ramps for people to be an entrepreneur or to be a part of startups that otherwise wouldn't have the opportunity to do so, but who have necessary talents and also necessary insight.
Well, I think I really appreciate that. And that, I think that's, great advice, really. So I'm going to leave it there.
Cool.
MK, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for doing this.
That was Mary Catherine Keller from Watson Institute. Find her on Twitter at MCAT, K-A-T, Keller, and get more info at watsonuniversity.org. Episode 17 of the Boulder Tech Podcast is presented by Boulder Startup Week Adventure Track sponsor, Brandzuka. The Boulder Tech Podcast is made possible in part by Boulder Startup Week Platinum sponsors, Matter, Zayo, Google, and Boulder Engineering Studio. We're also presented by Glider, a Colorado-based community movement and nonprofit that produces Boulder's Ignite and TEDx events, as well as Boulder Startup Week. Learn more and consider a donation at glider.com. Thanks to Dojo 4 for providing space for our podcast studio and to KGNU Community Radio for the recording gear. Our intro music is by Echodeck, that's E-C-C-O-D-E-K. Hear more at echodeck.com. Our outro music is by Earthrise Sound System. You'll find them at earthrisesoundsystem.com. The Boulder Tech Podcast is produced by me, Joel Davis. Your feedback, criticisms, and comments are welcome. Reach me at joel@thevibrarian.co. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here for the next episode of the Boulder Tech Podcast.